Uncertainty isn't just a challenge, it's a call to adapt. At Tagoras, we help organizations navigate disruption with clarity and confidence. Whether it's making smarter decisions about your portfolio, understanding shifting market dynamics, or identifying new opportunities for growth, we bring deep experience in strategy, market assessment, and lifelong learning. If you're looking to build a more resilient, responsive learning business, we're here to help. Learn more at tagoras.com/clarity.
We want people to learn from their mistakes so they do better next time. We want them to reflect over practice so they can reflect in practice, but they will only do so if we have a high enough degree of psychological safety.
I'm Salisa Steele.
I'm Jeff Cobb, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast. If the goal of so much professional learning is improving the skills and abilities of learners on the job, then why put theory and methods before practice opportunities? That question gets at the core of reflective practice-based learning, which is an approach that emphasizes practice before theory. Anna-Sophie Vallet-Müller, a learning and development expert, is passionate about helping educators and leaders create more practice-based, learner-centered experiences. In this episode, number 435, Anna-Sophie talks with Salisa about how reflective practice-based learning works and how it's being applied in various contexts, including her experience with the Danish Defense. Salisa and Anna-Sophie also discuss the importance of psychological safety in learning environments, emotional intelligence and leadership, and how self-determination theory aligns with reflective learning. Salisa and Anna-Sophie spoke in August 2024.
Reflexive practice-based learning is an area of focus for you. So what led you to choose that as a focus area?
So reflective practice-based learning is something that I really started being interested in when working for the Danish Defense. Because, you know, at the end of the day, soldiers are practitioners. And when you work in Denmark, at least with reflective practice-based learning, it is the University College of Aalborg who invented that and who's been working with that and refining that approach for years. So basically what this approach to learning and development does is that it takes practice before theory, right? So what happens when you are solving your task or when you're taking your classes or when you are just doing the job? And basically, that is the center and the starting point for the learning and development that takes place. So educators, they will look for those learning occasions. And that could be cases from practice, scenarios from practice. If whatever you, maybe you're a registered nurse or you're a soldier or you work with learning and development, you will look for occasions that calls for learning and development. So as an educator, the first thing I would do when starting in a class or a lecture or doing my curriculum is I will share a story maybe of something that took place in practice. And I often like, not all educators like them, but I like to use the narrative. I like to use the story because we have a tendency to lean into when someone telling us a story about something that took place in practice. If you think about it, then it's really just a way of also working with embodied learning. You are just looking for the embodied emotion. It could also just be any sort of obstacle course that you have your students or your participants do first. So basically, I'm going a long way around to say, have them have an experience first before you do anything else. And of course, you want them to experience something related to what you would like for them to acquire of knowledge, skills, and competencies. But you will do so in order to create what we call the teachable moment. Right? An example that I like, even though it's a bit dramatic, of a teachable moment is, of course, like young people joining gangs is a problem. And we had really good, well-trained social workers trying to go out in the streets and connect to the young people and said, this is bad for you and we have this program, you should join. But the success rate wasn't very high in doing that. But if you look for a teachable moment and you put all your resources and all your well-trained people into the situation where you have a young person waking up in a hospital room, gathered around is the family, grandma's worried, right? And you say, so we have this problem to get you out, you know, off the street and not be in a gang. I know this is a bit dramatic, but for the sake of the argument, that's the teachable moment. And I think as educators, if we just start with, so this is my course, and this is what I would like for them to know, I will instantly just start telling them things. I will start pouring knowledge in their direction. But several things are wrong with that. Number one, knowledge doesn't necessarily lead to action. If it did, like, look at where we would be, because we have all the knowledge accessible, don't we, to us? It's just on your phone. So we'd all be like rich and healthy with six packs if knowledge led to actual practice, right? Or actual behavior, but it doesn't. And also, if you don't create a teachable moment, you don't have the need to learn and to develop. So you sort of take the autonomy away from the learner.
In some of those examples, it's almost a bit about the learning in the flow of work and life. I mean, you were talking about sort of the teachable moment, but then it also seems like you were suggesting, though, that it can also be created, that it could be more of like, even if you know you're going to have a seminar that's going to happen on a particular day and time, which isn't necessarily tied to each specific learner having a moment of need right then, you know, because this is going to happen on Wednesday at noon, but that you could still sort of tap into that, the idea of not leading with theory. And because by telling that narrative, by telling that story, getting someone to sort of emotionally engage, you're beginning to create that curiosity or their own sort of internal desire or acknowledgement of, yes, I do need to know more. This is interesting. So is that true? You can sort of either wait for the learner to have that realization and really kind of then have a resource available in that moment, or you can sort of try to create that receptivity to learning, try to create that teachable moment. Is that correct? Is that fair?
Yeah, that's absolutely what you would do, because of course, in the best of all worlds, it would happen naturally, right? So you will constantly, as an educator, think of yourself as a designer of learning opportunities. Don't be so caught up in what do I want them to know, because that leads to what can I tell them? But think about, what do I want them to experience? What do I want them to feel? What do I want them to acknowledge? Of course, that is quite humbling as well. But being able to think like a designer, so you constantly, that's what I do, and that's what I encourage everyone to do, constantly look for those occasions. Gather. If you hear a story, write it down, right? If you hear a podcast or a conversation, note that down. If you see a clip of a film or a movie, save that as well. So I have a huge repertoire of just like learning occasions. And I also, when I teach myself, it's very rare that I ask people to read things beforehand. But what I will ask them to do is to share learning occasions or experiences or stories from their own practice. So I will gather these as well. So just think of, as an educator, so you think of whatever course that you are responsible for, whatever curriculum you might have, look at where would be a good point to collect stories from the learner's practice and have them handed in beforehand. And you can use it when you want. And I did that. I taught a bunch of cadets, and that was actually how to lead learning. So before the course started, what I did was quite briefly explained, like, how do you write a case, right? You need a setting, you need some interaction, you need some people present, you need something to happen, conflict, and a few examples. And then they just wrote situations that they have seen in their training of learning occasions that either was really, really good, right? Learning really took place here. This was a great situation, or a situation where learning was just like dropped on the floor. And they came up with so many brilliant cases, and I could use that. And I could like look at, what would I like for them to discover? What would I like for them to feel, to acknowledge, to experience? And I just use their own cases. You know, if you use the participants' own cases, you make sure that this is really true to practice. And if it didn't happen to you yet, it will probably happen to you soon, right? And with that acknowledgement, it's more their levels of proficiency and what they need in terms of learning and development. What knowledge, skills, and competencies do they need to acquire next? And they're behind the steering wheel.
At Tagoras, we partner with professional and trade associations, continuing education units, training firms, and other learning businesses to help them understand market realities and potential, to connect better with existing customers and find new ones, and to make smart investment decisions around product development and portfolio management. Drawing on our expertise in lifelong learning, market assessment, and strategy formulation, we can help you achieve greater reach, revenue, and impact. Learn more at tagoras.com/more.
Is this a sort of an approach to learning that really does require that human facilitator, that human educator to be responsive in the moment? Or have you seen this potentially work in any sort of asynchronous, more e-learning type approach? Could one apply that there as well?
So when you look at reflective practice learning, when learning is taking place, meaning like we will become better in the future, is the difference, and this also lies in the research of Donald Schoen, but reflection in practice and reflection on practice. So reflection in practice is when we seamlessly, fluently able to navigate in solving the task. So for instance, if you and I were having a conversation and I'm trying to come across with this point of whatever, and I have a faint idea we're going to end over there. That's the goal of the conversation. But I can just see it's not going well. You know, the way maybe I can see by your eyebrows, the way you like clench your eyes a little bit, and I can hear it in your voice. This is not going in the direction that I want. So if I reflect in practice, I'm just going to change my example. I'm going to maybe just check my body language. I am going to maybe ask you more questions to get a feel of what you're at. And that's navigating in practice. And the bigger the repertoire, the more efficient you are, the more expertise you will have. And that's reflection in practice. Reflection on practice is what happens afterwards, after the conversation has ended or the one you were trying to talk to has stormed out the door, right? Then you will reflect over practice. And the better you are reflecting over practice, what didn't go as planned? What didn't go according to plan and why? The better you are at that discipline, the more you build up your repertoire of being able to navigate in the different situations that you find yourself in solving your tasks. And basically, that's what needs to be present in reflective practice learning, that practice is the starting point, it's the center point, but it's reflection over that enables us to reflect in. And we could, like, we don't need necessarily a teacher to do that. Just two coworkers who's doing a project together can do that just as easily. I think one of the researchers, Mads Hermansen, behind this theory, I think he puts it like this. A lot of reflection simply doesn't take place because we can't stand ourselves. We can't stand the fact that the good that we wanted to do, right, turned out not to be great at all. So instead of just being in that situation, you and I, maybe we had a project, the idea was great, right? So let's say it was the best idea ever. This project is going to be great. And it didn't. We failed along the way. So of course, that's really painful. And that's very fragile and vulnerable to go into that room. And a lot of reflection doesn't take place because we can't stand ourselves. But the thing is, if you set out to do that, and if you have, wherever you work or you study, know that this is what we need to do just in order to learn from what takes place in practice, the next time we will be so much better. We will not repeat the same errors that we already did, which people do. Like we know this from Kahneman as well, right? Optimism bias, it's a strong one. So like next time we'll get a project similar, right? And we'll go like, last time wasn't that bad.
Define for us psychological safety and its role in learning. Why is it important in terms of learning?
I stumbled upon psychological safety when I was trying to look for that missing link for reflective practice-based learning. Because in the defense, we have structures to support reflective practice-based learning. We have after actions review. We have lessons identified, lessons learned. But the thing is, if we want these structures to work, it will need a high enough level of psychological safety to be able to learn from what took place in practice, especially the things that we hoped were different. So psychological safety is, of course, based on the work of Dr. Amy Edmondson, and it has gone like a whirlwind over Denmark. When I talk about psychological safety, I normally start with saying, and this is directly just a quote from Dr. Edmondson, it's about the ability to be comfortable in the uncomfortable. Because it sounds like, especially in the Danish translation, we won't go there now, but it sounds a lot like, let's all be friends, let's have a good time, which is great, by all means, like be friends and have a good time. But that's not the essence of psychological safety. So basically, it is the belief in a team that you can speak your mind, you can be honest about your doubts, your suggestions, your mistakes, and your new ideas without the fear of being excluded, being ridiculed, being frowned upon, because you know from experience that it's worth that risk. And I think it's very important to always remember when you work with psychological safety to understand the social aspect of why is it difficult. Psychological safety, when you are able to be uncomfortable in the uncomfortable, is that you're willing to take interpersonal risks. And this is what we constantly do when we have to be honest with one another. So to understand that as social beings, human beings, we are hardwired to do everything we can to stay in the group. We do not want to be excluded. We do not want to be the one eaten by the saber tooth, right? We need to stay in that group, like our lives are dependent on it. So of course you have strategies for staying in that group, for not being excluded. And if you look at it like that, who do you want to exclude? Well, we don't like if people are too pushy, right? If you don't want to come across as pushy, you just don't suggest things, right? You don't come up with new angles or new ideas. So let's do that. And I know, like we said on this meeting 2 weeks ago, that we were going this direction. But now, come to think of it, and what I think maybe that would be a bad idea. Maybe we should go in that direction. If I don't want to come across as uncertain, insecure, not worthy of my job or my position, don't express doubts, right? Don't say, I'm not sure. I don't, what do you think we should do? Because I'm not really sure. I'm in over my head here a little bit. Of course, if you don't want to seem like you don't know what you're doing, you don't admit to errors. You don't admit to failures. So basically, these are pretty good strategies for not being excluded from the group. But the thing is, it hinders learning. If you don't have a high enough degree of psychological safety, you talk about what you dare talk about, not what's important, not what you actually need to talk about. And of course, everybody is so interested in psychological safety because it is the clearest link to high performance teams. But what they're actually able to do is they're able to develop anti-fragility, if you will use Taleb's term here, which means that bad things can happen. Right. But we'll still learn from it. I like anti-fragility because normally we talk about being robust. I want people to be robust. But robust is just the ability to take a hit from the side and just get up and soldier on. What we want is anti-fragility. We want people to learn from their mistakes so they do better next time. We want them to reflect over practice so they can reflect in practice. But they will only do so if we have a high enough degree of psychological safety.
How can we promote psychological safety? And I'm thinking, you know, for our listeners, that can mean within their teams internally, but also with those learners that they're bringing together to help them learn something new. How can they help those learners or their teams or both feel that psychological safety so that they do feel like they can engage, that they can share their, you know, mistakes, and we can all then therefore learn from them?
I look for learning occasions, like deal cases and stories, and right? But I also like quotes, I collect them as well. And I think one that really nails it, Scott Stratton, and he says something like, you're not a team unless you have each other's back. Then you're just a bunch of random people working for the same person. And I think have each other's back, what does that look like? That's a conversation you need to have in a learning community or a community of practice. there's 5 steps you can use. I mentioned Christian Ørsted before. Amy Edmondson works with 3 steps. He works with 5. And what I really like about this is he starts with the task in hand. So we are a group of learners or a group of workers. And what are we trying to achieve here? What is the task in hand? What does it look like when we're doing a good job? Step number 1, make sure you have that in order, because that's very different from like from situation to situation, from team to team. It's not something that is the same all over. What are we trying to do here? So if as a soldier, is this a day at the office or are you in a combat zone? The way you lead will be very different. The way you communicate will be very different. And every time I find it, not every time, but a lot of time when working communities don't work really well, it's actually really helpful just to go back and say, what are we trying to solve? What does it look like when we're doing a good job? So as an educator, have your students facilitate, but have your students have that conversation. What is the task at hand? Well, we're trying to learn here, for instance, right? Number 2, who are the participants? Who are we? So for instance, if we are in a learning situation, what we are learning is quite new, quite complex, and it's also something where we are pushed to our limits, say, for instance, right? So what personalities, what expertise, and what experience are we putting in the mix? So have a talk about who are you as a person? What do you bring to the table? Maybe also, if a lot of people like to talk about learning preferences, by all means, throw that in the mix as well. It's like, who are we dealing with here, right? And that leads us to number 3 would be like framing the house rules. So what we're trying to do and who we are, what would be some good house rules? And house rules will be the rules for how we communicate, how we cooperate, right? And also, if we spend more time together, what are the rules here? And have them give concrete behavioral examples. What does that look like? So if we disagree on something, how do we solve it? If something goes awry, how do we talk about it? When we disagree, if somebody loses their cool, how do we address that? Do we have a 24-hour rule to getting back to a conflict that happened? So we have, what's the task? Who are participating? What house rules do we need? And then you train and you have your students train inclusive behavior. So basically, how do we invite people in? And that could be as simple as asking questions, right? Having just a plan for inviting other people, listening to their suggestions. So for instance, if you have a study group, there's always a few people who always be the first to talk, then maybe you need a plan for how you begin your conversations. Maybe you need a plan where you say, or a work group, if we have a new task in hand, we will all spend like 5 minutes on just brainstorming and then we'll share our ideas, because it's always these two who just takes the reins and then go, right? The rest of us, like, we didn't even see what was happening. So having a conversation about that as well. And then you have number 5, which is committing to how will we respond to what we hope were different. That's really important as well, because you can have all the good intentions, but you need a plan for how to cope, how to talk about, how to address when it goes wrong, because it will. People working together, right? There's nothing wrong with that. We just need a plan before it actually happens.
Okay, so these 5 steps then can help a group of individuals coming together to work or to learn, create that sense of psychological safety, because then it makes clear, like everyone's clear about the task, everyone's clear about who's participating, and then they're clear about sort of all these behaviors, right? These rules that are going to govern behavior, making sure to be inclusive, and then being really clear about how to respond. So it sounds like potentially a lot of work to kind of lay that out and get that right as a group. Or do you see this happening pretty quickly, potentially?
It can. I have done this in like 15 minutes. I think it's so important, because learning is a delicate matter. Maybe like hardcore training, that's not as delicate, but learning is. And making sure that you have a good learning environment is crucial. So what you really give them when you support or facilitate that conversation, pretty much it's common sense, right? And what people come up with is common sense. It's like, let's listen, let's ask questions, let's not interrupt. If something is starting to go off a little bit, let's take a step back, like common sense. But what you give them in supporting that conversation is that they can do what you call reframe the rules. It's very difficult to say, like, and Sophia, you're interrupting again, and don't be too pushy, or that's difficult. But if we already have this conversation, it's very, very easy. Not true, but it's easy to say, so Anna Sophia, I can see you getting excited now, which is good. But we all agreed on that we wanted to take turns. And I think we should let Thomas finish what he was trying to say. So making a good learning environment, not about you being wrong, but it's about we already agreed on how we want things, and we will respectfully, lovingly, in a friendly manner, help each other to be true to these rules, right? Because we know that's what's best for our working community, our learning community.
I would just love to get your take on how self-determination theory aligns with reflective practice and kind of what role autonomy really plays in motivating adults who are going to be engaging with the learning.
So self-determination theory is not by any means new. It's invented by Daisy and Ryan back in the 80s. And because of Professor Ebbe Ravn here in Denmark, it is sort of taking a renaissance. And I think it has also deserved that revival or that renaissance because we see a lot of learning not taking place, a lot of motivation that seems to be lacking, both in educational context and in working context all over the world, actually. So lack of motivation and lack of thriving. And if you look at self-determination theory, that is a motivational theory, can provide with some of the answers to why. Where did that motivation go, right? Where did that thriving, where did that go to? It's important to distinguish between inner motivation and outer motivation. Outer motivation is the stick-a-carrot situation. And we also talk about, in a weird way, we talk about motivation as a sort of a quantity, like you don't have so much, that's not good. Maybe we should provide you with more, thinking that it's like solely external factors. And the external factors that we look for is either praise or punishment. So say, maybe you don't seem motivated. What if I give you some more money? What if I give you a prize? Employee of the week, gold star, good, great, all outer phenomenons. Or maybe I should try to punish you a little bit. Maybe I said, then you don't solve the test that you like. Maybe you can't work with that person. Maybe you don't get as much money. Maybe you get a bad grade. But these are all, like, somebody will, to some it will ring a bell. It's like, that sounds like behaviorism kind of a deal, right? Which is true. And what has been proven is that good, strong inner motivation that we all have, like we're human beings, we're natural curious. We are driven. We want to learn. We want to do better. We get excited about things, right? But a lot of research has been carried out, and it all showed that the more you focus on outer motivation, the more you ruin the good inner motivation. So every time you steer our attention to outer factors, outer motivation, we go like, why did she get a raise? I want a raise, right? I want a promotion. I deserve a good grade. And then we tend to not focus on we're doing this because it's meaningful. We're doing it because it caught our interest. We do it because we're curious. When you talk about self-determination theory, SDT, it's very much to do with inner motivation. This is what we focus on. Oh, quick note. If we look at outer motivation that I have so many bad things to say about, if you look at how the education system is built up, it has all to do with the grades. We don't learn biology because it's important. We don't learn history because we need to understand our past to understand our future, right? This is important. It's exciting. No, you need a good grade. And the same if you look at workplaces. Most workplaces, it's all about outer motivation as well. Self-determination theory is a way that enables, I think, educators and leaders, but also just teams as well, to work with inner motivation as a means to be motivated and to thrive your education or your work. So it's a trinity, if you think of it as sort of like a bar stool on three legs. You have the three areas that you will focus on. And the first leg is what we normally spend the most time on. It's not the most important, not according to Stacey and Ryan. They're all equally important, but we like to talk about the first one. And I think pretty much because it's what we're not succeeding in. First one is autonomy. So in order to be motivated and driven and finding your work or your studies meaningful, you need to be behind the steering wheel. In a learning and development context, that means that you need to have a leadership or an educator that enables you to use your expertise, to use your knowledge, skills, and competencies, to use whatever you might have in your backpack. So in SDT, you will look for as much autonomy as possible, not saying like do whatever you want, but steer them in a direction and give them as much influence as you possibly can. So say, for instance, I think psychological safety is great. I have some students, I have a course, let's teach psychological safety. Instead of just starting with, okay, so this is what I want them to know, so this is what I'm going to tell them. Instead, and I'm trying to connect some of the dots to where we started, I would look for the teachable moment. I would look for an experience. I'll use a story, I use a film clip, I use a case. I'll have them play out a scenario where they get a sense of psychological safety. And what does it mean if it's a very low level in a team of psychological safety, for instance? And then I will be interested in what do they want to learn next? What is for them most important? And how would they like to go about it? Because I could like, okay, so read chapter 1 to 5. In the Fearless Organization, listen to this podcast, listen to my lecture, and then we'll go on. But I'll listen to them. How do they want to work with it? Maybe they find it meaningful to call an expert. Maybe they want to write, you know, read some of the original work of Amy Edmondson. There could be so many suggestions, but that doesn't have to be left up to me. Of course, it could be that they go, well, we would actually like a lecture on this and that, according to psychological safety. But again, I'm sure, where can I protect, so to speak, their autonomy? As a leader, if you're working on a project, I'll say, I think you'd be great for this project. This is what it looks like now. But, you know, with your expertise, what do you think that we should do? Is there something that you're seeing? And how do you want to execute it? So you start off by thinking, how much influence can I give my learners or my coworkers or my employees? So autonomy, we're behind the steering wheel. Number two is the need to feel competent, right? The need for competencies. So it's not good if we are behind the steering wheel if we don't know how to drive. So as a leader and an educator, you will then provide whatever they need to be able to acquire knowledge, skills, and competencies. And if we circle back to reflective practice-based learning, this is where theory comes in. This is where they're ready to fulfill that need. But I will try to angle it in a way, as an educator, that we touch or angle at least what they ask for. And the third is, and here we're circling back to psychological safety, we need to be a part of a meaningful community. This is where we're the most motivated. This is where we have a tendency to thrive, right? So we need a workplace, or we need a study group where we can show up every day and feel like we're being treated well. We are being respected. We are being appreciated. We are being listened to. We need to feel listened to in order to feel like we belong. So these are like the three core needs. And if they're being fulfilled, you would see a lot of inner motivation in your learners, in your employees as well. So basically, how do you work with that? You use practice, right? You use examples from practice, you use casework, you use your narratives, your movie clips. You make sure as an educator, you have your repertoire already. You don't necessarily have the whole plan for how this is going to play out. But most educators, if they have like a course they're teaching or a subject that they're teaching, they will have it all in their repertoire. Maybe you as an educator decide, well, A is here and then we're going to end over there. But that's not necessarily the way the learning is. The learners are more motivated. And that's not necessarily the teachable moments. Have your students decide that.
Talk a little bit about what might be the barriers to really trying to tap into that internal motivation of the learners, really allowing that self-determination theory to be at work in what learning businesses are offering. What are those obstacles that you tend to see? And if you have solutions for kind of how to work around some of those barriers and obstacles?
Brilliant questions. Also the hardest. I think there's definitely some barriers that derives from how we traditionally view the role of the educator, the oracle, the expert, right? The one with the plan. Not saying that educators shouldn't have a plan. Plan is always good. But as educators and teachers, we will definitely, learning and teaching using the approaches that we just talked about is not a traditional role of the educator, right? We like holding the reins. We like a more linear form of teaching. As I said, we start here and then I have the whole plan. You're going to end over here. But the thing is, it often leaves the learner passive, and that's not what we want. Hence, acquiring knowledge, skills, and competencies, not being poured into, right? So the traditional role as the teacher is what hinders us the most. I think it's the uncertainty that teachers don't appreciate. Oh, where is that going to go? But the thing is, they know, right? Because they know their subject so well. So it's not very often that something will fall outside your repertoire. But also you said, so maybe you want something that you really want to tell them that you find is really important. But if there's no teachable moment for it, chances are the knowledge that you pour in that direction without them having a need for it is just going to vaporize. Look for their motivation. What do they want to learn? What do they find is interesting? And you will see a different form of energy. This is also what you need. And of course, as educator, you know best. All educators know best. And that's just the rule of law. But sometimes we don't. But what we're really good at is looking at our students, listening to our students, and seeing what are their learning and development needs? Where are they? I think most educators, they know their participants and they know like their zone of proximal development. They know that. Right? They have a knack for that. They develop that throughout the years. And basically, this is just what you use in designing learning opportunities, in choosing what cases to use, what stories to tell them. And I think the role of the educator, but I think also the role is as the learner. Over the years, we have been very keen to just bombard our students with information. And if you look at your students and you see this kind of grayish color in their skin, that's because they're just fatigued from information overload, not just in class, but like everywhere. The way we design traditional teaching has taught learners to be passive and to be like more or less numb recipients of knowledge being poured in that direction. So they also need to have skin in the game to think that's a good idea as well. You need to have that conversation with your students and says, this is the way I would like to do things. But in order to do that, you need to come out of your shells a little bit, right? And you will need to, you know, I'm standing, you know, putting myself in a kind of vulnerable situation because I don't necessarily have all the answers. There will be some things where you suggest, this is what we want to learn next. I go like, phew. I think it's important. And I think if I look at like the objectives from this course, it's definitely relevant as well. I need a little, like, not this lesson, maybe like in a week, we'll get back to that. But when, so what? Nobody ever said you're a bad teacher because you said, let's get back to that. But training your students in wanting to reflect together, reflect on practice, to be willing to have the humbling experience that it is when you set out to do something and you're not perfect at it.
I do know that emotional intelligence is an area where you've given thought. And so I just would love to kind of get your perspective and thinking about our listeners who are trying to lead the learning function at their organization and thinking about what they're offering out to prospective learners in the portfolio and then with their own team. So just maybe talk a little bit about kind of how you see emotional intelligence, the role of it in leaders and potentially maybe if there's any particular lens for learning leaders, what that role of emotional intelligence might be.
Of course, I think emotional intelligence is really important when you talk about learning and development. Being a leader or being an educator, their learning and development is your responsibility. And what is quite important is to be able to be a leader and educator that is very humble about what you do. And emotional intelligence has everything to do with what feelings do you drive for yourself and what feelings do you drive for others. If I don't want to reel too far off the railway tracks, if you look at psychological safety in a work group or a group of students, what we find is the ones that has a high degree or high level of psychological safety will have a high degree of what's called social sensitivity, which is basically the ability to listen and listen to understand, not just listen to respond or to attack or to ignore. So emotional intelligence, you will be very good at asking questions, understanding others, meaning if a situation is starting to go awry, you will be able to, and again, circling back, reflect and practice. I can see that this is not going where I want it to, so I will change it up a bit. I think, as I said, psychological safety is the answer that I found. It was the missing link to reflective practice-based learning. Emotional intelligence is the missing link to leading psychological safety.
We always like to ask guests who come on about their own approach to lifelong learning, how they approach it. I'm especially interested in your answer, just given everything that we've already talked about and just how much awareness you have of what goes into effective learning. But are there habits or practices or sources that you use to continue to learn?
You know, different strokes for different folks, but I like podcasts a lot. And I think that's definitely where I go to find new information. I listen to recommendations like, oh, have you check out this podcast? And I always will. I like the conversation. I think just listening to two people reflect together is so interesting. So that's where I get a lot of my knowledge from. Then I think for me, I am blessed with having some brilliant people that I work with throughout the years. And just to make sure, if you meet someone who's really interesting and preferably maybe doesn't look like you or you the world the same way you do, hang on to those, like with everything you got. Make sure that you just talk, you know, when you're doing something new, when you look at a new project or whatever, give them a call. Say, this is what I'm looking at. Like, can we talk about this?
Anna-Sophie Velud-Müller is a learning and development expert on a crusade to help steer education and leadership in a more practice-based, learner-oriented direction. In the show notes at leadinglearning.com/episode435, you'll find a link to Anna-Sophie's profile on LinkedIn.
At leadinglearning.com/episode435, you'll also find options for subscribing to the podcast. We'd be grateful if you would subscribe if you haven't yet, as subscriptions give us some insight into the impact of the podcast.
We'd also be grateful if you would rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, especially if you find the Leading Learning Podcast valuable. Those ratings and reviews help us show up when people search for content on leading a learning business.
And please help us grow the Leading Learning community. At leadinglearning.com/episode435, there are links to connect with us on LinkedIn, X, and Facebook.
Thanks again, and see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.